Add the two figures. They found he was asking for about 400 more men than I'd allowed for, mm-hmm. which wasn't too bad.
Mm-hmm. What was his figure? Was it like 3,000 men?
About 3,700, I think, mm-hmm. was the initial. And it was after that that they broke it up into Yugoslavia providing so many,
Sweden.
And the Brazilians provided so many, and the Danes provided so many, and Canada provided all the administrative.
The transport too, I think, didn't it?
Canada provided all the administration. The states provided the vehicles.
Okay, tell me about
that. A very interesting little sideline, the Brazilian contingent, mm-hmm. which has never been publicized, but the Americans equipped it mm-hmm. and fitted it out. And the Brazilians made just about the world's longest trip from Rio to Port Said. Because while they were at sea, everybody on board, the crew and soldiers, were getting special pay. So the Navy, particularly the Brazilian Navy, wanted this trip to last as long as possible. And they lasted as long as possible. And when they got to Port Said, they took an awful long time to unload. Mm-hmm. And they took an awful long time to get ready to return because they were getting special pay all the time. Mm-hmm. For example, the Brazilian major who was on the Secretary General's military advisor staff, mm-hmm. he, I think at that time in 1957, he was on a special allowance of, I think it was $150 or $200 a day. And he was living in a room that was costing about $50 a month. Mm-hmm. A room, I gather, I never saw it, but I gather, was a room in a district that you wouldn't be seen dead in. But he was saving every bit of his money. He was buying, he bought, at the time when I was there, he bought two Cadillacs on time. And he was buying refrigerators and electric stoves. And he got an extension of his service in New York. And he was delighted because he'd be able to get more of this stuff. And he was having it all put onto a ship, sent back to Rio, and he's going to sell it all at Dockside. And he says, I'll make enough money from that, I'll be able to retire.
Dedicated, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. I tell you, these fellows are dedicated.
Well, tell me now, the Brazilians, you say the Americans fitted them, outfitted them. Why did they have to do this? Why couldn't the Brazilians use their own equipment?
The Brazilians, their own equipment? They never have had their own equipment.
Didn't they fight in Italy with the... Wasn't there a Brazilian brigade fighting in Italy during the war?
Well, they were there.
Yeah.
And the Brazilians were in Korea, mm-hmm. equipped by the United States.
Yeah.
But they never had enough equipment left over to equip another contingent to go somewhere. They always got the states to equip them.
Okay.
And if it wasn't for the states, don't forget, if it wasn't for the United States funding, there'd be no United Nations.
Well,
because Russia doesn't pay its share yeah. of everything.
And none of the Warsaw Pact countries do either, but if I remember correctly, there's a
Third world countries don't.
Yeah.
And if it wasn't for the United States and Canada, but the United States particularly, there would be no United Nations whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
There'd be no public forum for the countries of the world.
Unfortunately, it doesn't seem like the forum for the world is faring too well right now.
No. But then it's never had any power.
It exerted some power in Korea, I think, as a unified
That's
force.
Because of Truman.
Because of Truman, then?
But again, it was an American operation in the name of the United Nations.
Yeah. The United Nations sort of came in behind the Americans.
That's right.
Yeah. But still, at least it showed some degree of unification, whereas since then, the United Nations really haven't done that much in terms of opposing...
Not on the military side, but they have done a heck of a lot on the medical... and
humanitarian
side.
Yeah.
But again, it's mainly American support,
mm-hmm.
along with a few countries like Canada
and
Great Britain. But don't bother about the third world countries and don't bother about the Iron Curtain countries.
Yeah, they can't afford, they won't afford it.
That's right.
Okay, I wanted to ask you about Mike Pearson. What sort of working arrangement did you have with him and how well did you know him?
I didn't know him well.
Colonel Pope, Mr. Pearson, was...
No, he called me Pope.
Yeah.
Which is a normal way in any English public school, and he'd been to Cambridge.
Yeah. And was he Pearson to you?
And he was Sir to me. Mm-hmm. I never called him Mr. Pearson, I called him Sir. But I found him a charming individual, a man who could get a lot of work out of me because he asked me in such a nice way to do it. Mm-hmm. I knew I couldn't refuse, but and I wouldn't refuse, but I was willing to work because he appeared to be understanding. He knew he was putting you under stress, mm-hmm. but he was nice about it.
Yeah.
And he was not backward in giving one a good pat on the back if he thought you'd done a good job.
Mm-hmm.
And I may say that the good old chiefs of staff never ever let me know whether I was a fool or what I'd done in my paper or whether it was good or whether it was bad. So I assumed that because I heard nothing that was acceptable. But I guess that's the normal way with chiefs of staff.
Yes, no
but way. Pearson I found utterly charming. I would have been quite happy to play ping pong with him or anything else.
Mm-hmm. You like the person.
But as a politician, that's a different question altogether. I wish to God he'd never got into it.
You did?
Yeah.
When you say politician, do you mean at the leadership level?
He was not. As a politician, as a Prime Minister of Canada,
mm-hmm.
He had pierced his ceiling.
I think so.
And as Minister of External Affairs,
he was brilliant.
That was his job.
Yeah.
He was brilliant. And he was made for that. But to be Prime Minister, no.
I suppose the same could be said for Anthony Eden in Britain.
Yes.
He tried to take on too much.
Yep. The big trouble is there are some people who can be prime ministers, and there are other people, if they try to be, they pierce their own ceiling.
Look at Winston Churchill. He wasn't that great as Chancellor of the Exchequer or First Lord of the Admiralty.
But he was a damn good prime minister.
Very good. He could rally the
yeah.
people, and he did rally
That's
the people.
Right.
Well, let's get back on track, because we always get off it. We're back at the UN. Your plan has been... accepted? Not your appreciation.
The figures, Pearson accepted the figures which I developed
mm-hmm.
in my appreciation.
And he announced this to the General Assembly.
He announced it to the General Assembly that afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, it was just go ahead with the UN force.
Yeah.
And it was a matter of the troops gathering together.
Okay. And
good old Canadians were doing the administration. And their request for supplies of various kinds, including sunglasses, you had to see their requests. They were unbelievable.
Mm.
What was the size of the force? Around about 3,700 total. And they wanted, I think, there's 5,000 or 6,000 pairs of sunglasses.
Why 5,000 or 6,000? Two for each man?
Well, this is what I asked.
Yeah.
Because the director of supplies of the United Nations came to me and said, what should I do about this? And I said, I would just cut them right back.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, if they squawk, then they'd have to give you reasons why.
Mm-hmm.
He said, well, what do you mean? He said, this has come from Burns' headquarters. I said, yes, but I'm pretty sure I know who put in that request. I said, he's a well-trained Canadian Army staff officer. And I said, if I was you, working here at the senior headquarter level, I said, just cut them down to 1,500
mm-hmm.
pairs of sunglasses. And I said, that's being generous. I said the only people that really need them are the drivers of the vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, oh. I said, do it.
Mm-hmm.
So he did. And he said, well, if anything happens, he said, I'm going to say that you told me. And I said, fine. And there was never any squawk.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, UN people had to be educated too. But we our fellows did a first class job.
Mm-hmm.
And the UN boys realized it up on the staff.
You
in fact, they thought we had sent specially selected officers to do the job out there. And I said, no, they're just the run-of-the-mill Canadian Army staff are good staff officers.
But they were that good that they were.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
And the streets ahead of anybody else. And they still are.
Mm-hmm. But there's so few of them.
Yes.
Staff, but the whole force is just too few of them.
Oh, yes.
So that's a whole nother...
Another thing altogether.
That is a whole thing in itself.
Well, that really sort of terminates because I finished up my army career as GSO1 cadets.
Mm-hmm.
And I thoroughly enjoyed being with cadets.
Well, what does one do when you're GSO1 as cadets?
Well, you look at the training program for cadets where they need to be improved. Something may become redundant.
Mm-hmm.
And... you try and inject a bit of enthusiasm into cadet training, which is not too hard as long as you can get out to the field and get it going. I found the cadets were just terrific, and I capped it all by being selected to be the commandant of the National Cadet Camp at Banff in 1959, I think it was, and that's when the Queen and Prince Philip were doing a tour of the West, and they came and visited the camp. And so I have photographs of the Queen and me having a nice confidential chat.
What did you say to her?
Oh, I don't know. We talked about quite a number of things. We were standing on the stoop of the cadet lounge, main lounge, and having a very nice talk there about cadet activities, where the boys came from, and so forth, because they came from all over Canada. And we were having a nice chat there, and suddenly a head poked itself between us and said, "My dear, I think we should be moving." And the Queen, that was Prince Philip, and the Queen turned to me and said, "I don't know what his hurry is, because I didn't hurry him when he was watching the ballet class at the Banff School of Fine Arts."
She does have a good sense of humor.
I tell you, as far as I'm concerned, if she'd said to me at that moment, "Go climb that mountain," I'd have climbed it. Oh, she was wonderful.
Yeah. I guess you thought quite a bit of what happened yesterday with the baby being born.
Yes.
That was kind of nice.
Yeah. And that terminated my career.
Well, let me ask you something about that posting. Was it a plum posting, or was it seen as sort of a demotion? Because you were an active staff officer, and here you were being shunted off. If it is being shunted off to cadet.
I felt I was shunted off, that I was near the end of age for rank.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're pushing 50, perhaps.
51. Mm-hmm. And age for rank, you go. Yeah. Unless there is a promotion before you get to age for that rank. If I'd happened to have been promoted to full colonel, I could then go on for another 3 or 4 years.
Mm-hmm. With the hopes of perhaps becoming a brigadier?
Yeah, maybe. Mm-hmm. But I was happy to have gone as far as I did go. And so I ceased to be employed with effect December 1962.
Weren't you somehow connected with the PPCLI for a short time?
Well, in 1954, Army headquarters decided that officers who'd been with wartime militia units, mm-hmm. like I'd been with the Sea Force, and that I'd continued to wear Seaforth uniform after becoming a regular Army officer, that this practice should cease, that I should, and others like me, should wear the uniform of a regular force unit. So I was given the option of choosing to try and join any of the then regular force units. And they were the Patricias, the RCR, the Black Watch, the Vandoos, and I don't think that the Canadian Guards had been formed in those days.
I think that came later. It was under Pearson, wasn't it?
Just later, yes. Anyway, I chose the Patricias first because they'd been in the same brigade, Seaforth, and I knew many of the Patricia officers. I then put the Black Watch and then the RCR.
Wasn't Cease Merritt at that time Lieutenant Colonel of the regiment?
No. Oh, back in as a militia unit.
Was it a militia unit?
Yeah.
I know he was connected with it sometime in the 50s.
Seaforth, yes. He was with them, but I'm not sure what years he was. There was also a fellow called Gray who was commanding officer of the Seaforth. Mm-hmm. And he had been an intelligence officer in the Seaforth after me.
Mm-hmm. Did it rankle you having to do this because you were a loyal Seaforth?
No, it made sense to me.
Did it?
I was surprised that I'd been allowed to continue to wear Seaforth uniform for so long. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I put Patricia's at the top of my list, and I was very happy that they said, "We'll accept him." But I never served with Patricia's. I was still a staff officer.
Mm-hmm. But you wore their uniform?
I wore their uniform, and I still do. I can no longer get the kilt that I had. So I don't wear that, but I am a life member of the Seaforth Association, and have strong connections with them, correspondence, mm-hmm. but that's all nowadays. Mm-hmm. And after I left the Army, I, for want of a job, I am being retired while serving in Ottawa. The only place I could find a job was in Ottawa, and that happened to be with the personnel division of the Canadian Penitentiary Service.
And how long did you work there?
I worked there for 12 years.
Until you retired and came out to Victoria?
And then I retired, and shortly after I put in my notice to retire from the Penitentiary Service, I got a phone call from a friend of mine in the BC government saying they had a special project, which would be only about a two-year project. Would I be interested in coming out to be the administrative officer for that project? And I said, yes. And so I came out to Victoria, and so glad we did.
Who was your friend? Would it be one of your old Seaforth?
No, he was not.
I was going to say, perhaps it was Del Irving or
no,
Fulton.
It was somebody who I had met while I was with the Penitentiary Service, and who had come out and was working with the BC government at the time.
So you've been living in Victoria ever since?
Thank goodness.
It's beautiful, isn't it? Especially on a day like today.
Just tremendous.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's wrap
so,
up. Oh, my name will end up by saying you're working for the RUSI now, aren't you?
I'm now the Secretary Treasurer for the RUSI, which I find very interesting because I'm working with service people,
mm-hmm.
and I find that they are the, generally speaking, are the easiest people to work for.
From my experience, they're also some of the nicest and easiest to get to know. They're just nice people. They're just,
yeah, I think. Yeah. Why can't there be more like us?
On that note, I'm with you. Thank you very much.